Chapter 20. An inauspicious 9 hours later, Gideon and Harrow were making their way down the long, cold staples of the facility ladder, the air thick with last night's blood. Having been woken up just 35 minutes previous, Harrow always lied. Gideon climbed down into the dark with the distinct sensation that she was still asleep, somewhere in a dream she'd had a long time ago and suddenly remembered. She had mechanically downed the mug of cooling tea and the bowl of congealing porridge that Harrow had brought her that morning. Harrow arranging her breakfast was a concept so disagreeable there was no space left in her head for it, and now it sat leadenly in her stomach. The crumpled note lay hastily interred at the very bottom of Gideon's pocket. Everything felt dark and strange and incorrect, right down to the still-drying paint her adept had applied to her face. Gideon had not even murmured dissent at this incursion, just got on with spooning porridge into her mouth. It was testament to Harrow being Harrow that none of Gideon's wooden submission had even perturbed her, seemingly. "What the hell are we meant to be doing down there?" she'd asked plaintively as Harrow led the way back to the dim lobby and the stairs to the hatch. Her voice sounded odd in her mouth. "More bone men?"
"I doubt it," Harrow had said briskly, without looking around. "That was one challenge. There'd be no point doing the same thing for the next one."
"The next one?"
"For God's sake, pay attention, Griddle. The hatch key is the first step. The warm-up challenge, if you like."
"That wasn't a challenge," Gideon had objected, stepping over a taut strand of yellow tape. "You just asked teacher for it."
"Yes, and as we discovered, some of our so-called rivals hadn't even cleared that pitiable hurdle. The hatch key grants access to the facility complex, which contains a number of testing rooms set up to replicate particular necromantic experiments. Anyone who can accurately carry out an experiment to its intended conclusion, as we did by dismantling that construct, gets the reward."
"A key?"
"One assumes."
"And then the key, what, lets you into a room where you can rub your face all over ye oldie necro's oldie notebooks?" Harrow still didn't turn around, but Gideon knew innately that her eyes were rolling.
"The second house study contained a full and perfect explanation of the theorem which had been used to articulate the construct. Having studied that theorem, any halfway competent necromancer would be able to reproduce its effects. I now possess the competencies required to ride another living soul. I'm perhaps even more interested in what I've learned from the theorem behind the construct."
"Making big shitty bone hunks?" Gideon preferred not to think about riding another living soul.
At that, Harrow had stopped, almost at the head of the staircase, and finally looked around. "Nav," she'd said, "I could already make bone hunks, but now I can make them regenerate."
The outcome literally nobody wanted.
Now here they both were at the bottom of the ladder, staring at the angular outlines on the floor. Someone had immortalized Abigail and Magnus's descent with tape, carefully laid. It looked particularly weird, given that none of the blood had been cleaned up. Accusatory splotches of it lay skeletonized on the floor.
"Sextus," said Harrow, having dropped lightly down next to her. "The sixth is always too enamored of the body."
Gideon said nothing. Harrow continued. "Investigating the scene of death is barely useful compared to discovering the motives of the living. Compared to why, the question of who killed Penton Quinn is almost an aside."
"Who?" said a voice. "Or what? I love the idea of what."
Limned by the greenish light from the grill, Dulcinea Septimus limped into view. In the sulfide lamps, she looked transparent, and she was leaning heavily on crutches. Her heavy curls had been tied up on top of her head, revealing a neck that looked ready to snap in a strong wind.
Behind her hulked Protesilaus, who in the darkness looked like a mannequin with abs. Next to Gideon, Harrow Hark stiffened, very slightly.
Ghosts and monsters, the Lady of the Seventh continued enthusiastically. Remnants and the dead, the disturbed dead. The idea that someone is still here and furious, or that something has been lurking here forever. Maybe it's that I find the idea comforting, that thousands of years after you're gone is when you really live, that your echo is louder than your voice.
Harrow said, a spirit comes at invitation. It cannot sustain itself.
But what if one could, cried Dulcinea. That's so much more interesting than plain murder.
This time, neither of the ninth answered. Dulcinea moved forward, pressing her forearms into the clutches of her two metal poles and blinked soft brown lashes at them. Gideon noticed that she looked tired, still, that the veins at her temples stood out, that her hand shook just a little bit on each crutch. She was wrapped up in a robe of some pale blue stuff, embroidered with flowers, but still shivered with the chill.
Greetings, Ninth. You're brave to come down here after what teacher said.
One might, said Harrow, say the same of you.
Oh, by all rights, I ought to have been the first one to die, said Dulcinea, giggling a bit fretfully. But once one accepts that, one stops worrying quite so much. It would be so predictable to bump me off. Hello, Gideon. It's nice to see you again. I mean, I saw you last night, but you know what I mean. Oh, no. Now I sound like a dope. Still vowing silence?
Before that line of conversation could be pursued, the dark-hooded necromancer of the ninth said in her most sepulchrous and forbidding tones,
We have business down here, Lady Septimus. Excuse us. But that's just what I came to talk to you about, said the other necromancer earnestly. I think we four should team up.
Gideon could not hide an explosive snort of disbelief. There were maybe less likely targets for Harrow to team up with. Silas Soctakizeron, maybe, or Teacher, or the dead body of Magnus Quinn. In fact, Teacher would be a far better candidate. But Dulcinea's dreamy blue eyes were turned on Harrow, and she said,
I've already completed one of the theorem labs. I think I'm on the path to cracking another. If we both worked together, why then, there's the key in half the time with just a few hours' work.
This is not intended to be collaborative, Dulcinea said smilingly.
Why does everybody think that?
The women sized each other up. Dulcinea, leaning into her metal braces, looked like a brittle doll. Harrow, hooded and swathed in miles of black fabric, like a wraith. When she pulled away the hood, the older necromancer did not flinch, even though it was a deliberately chilling sight. The dark, cropped head, the stark paint on the face, the bone studs punched halfway up each ear.
Harrow said coolly, What would be in it for the ninth house? All my knowledge of the theory and the demonstration and first use of the key, said Dulcinea eagerly.
Generous. What would be in it for the seventh?
The key, once you're done. You see, I don't think I can physically do this one.
Stupidity, then, not generosity. You just told me you can't complete it. Nothing would stop my house from completing it without you.
It took me a long time to work out the theoretical parameters, said Dulcinea. So I wish you the best of luck, because even though I'm dying, there's nothing wrong with my brain.
Harrow pulled the hood back over her head, returning her to a wraith, a piece of smoke. She swept past the frail necromancer of the seventh, who followed her with the wistful, somewhat hungry expression that Dulcinea reserved for the shadowy nuns of the ninth, for the black robes whispering on the metal floor, the green light reflecting off dark fabric. Harrow Hark turned around and said curtly,
Well,
Are we doing this or not, Lady Septimus?
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Dulcinea said.
Gideon was stupefied. Too many shocks in 24 hours shut down her thought processes. As Dulcinea stumped along the corridor, crutches clanging unharmoniously on the grill, and as Protesilaus hovered behind her a half step away as though desperate to just scoop her up and carry her, Gideon strode to catch up with her necromancer. Only to find her swearing under her breath. Harrow whispered a lot of fuck words before muttering, "Thank God we got to her first." "I never thought you'd actually help out," said Gideon, grudgingly admiring.
"Are you dim?" hissed Harrow. "If we didn't agree, that bleeding heart Sextus would, and he'd have the key."
"Oh, whoops, my bad," said Gideon. "For a moment I thought you weren't a huge bitch." They followed the mismatched pair from the seventh house to the dusty facility hub, filled with its dusty panelling and its whiteboard gleaming sadly beneath big white lights. Dulcinea turned abruptly down the passageway marked Laboratory 710, a tunnel identical to the one they had taken to Laboratory 1-3. This time, the creaks and ancient moans of the building seemed very loud, their footsteps a huge addition to the cacophony. In the middle of a passage past the first laboratory rooms, the grill on the floor had been staved in, cracked right down the middle to come to rest on hissing pipes. Protesilaus picked up his adept and stepped her over this pit as lightly as thistledown. Gideon jumped the gap and turned back to see her necromancer hesitating on the edge, stranded. Why she did it, Gideon didn't know. Hera could have built herself a bridge of bones any second. But she grasped a railing, leaned over, and proffered her hand. Why Hera took it was an even bigger mystery. After being helped across, Hera spent a few moments officiously dusting herself off and muttering inarticulately. Then she strode off to catch up with, of all people, Protesilaus, apparently with the aim of engaging him in conversation. Dulcinea, who had taken a moment to fit herself back into her crutches, slipped one arm into Gideon's instead. She nodded at the broad span of her cavalier's back.
"Column the Eighth is fixing to fight him tomorrow," she said to Gideon beneath her breath. "I wish Master Silas had just fought me. Not much can hurt me any more. It would be an interesting sensation, is what I mean."
In response, Gideon's grip tightened around the languid arm tucked in her own. Dulcinea sighed, which sounded like air being pushed through whistly sponges. Up this close, her hair was very soft, Gideon noted dimly.
"I know. I was an idiot to let it happen, but the Eighth are so touchy in their own way, and Pro was unpardonably bad. They couldn't let the insult pass. I just let my worst instincts get the better of me, and yelped."
The curly-haired necromancer paused to cough, as though simply remembering how she'd yelped was enough to send her into spasms. Gideon instinctively put an arm around her shoulders, steadying her so that the crutches did not give way, and found herself looking down where the edge of Dulcinea's shirt met her bulging collarbones. A fine chain around her neck supported a rather less delicate bundle hanging tucked into her camisole. Gideon only saw them for a second, but she knew immediately what they were. The keyring was snapped around the chain, and on the keyring were two keys, the sawtoothed hatch key and a thick grey key with unpretentious teeth, the kind you'd lock a cabinet with. She made herself look anywhere else. By now they had reached the very end of the corridor, which terminated in a single door marked Laboratory 8. Wriggling free of Gideon's arm, Dulcinea opened it onto a little foyer alike in indignity to Laboratory 2. There were hooks on the walls here, and a bunch of old, crumpled boxes made of thin metal, the type you might carry files in. These were dented and empty.
Someone had taken the time and effort to affix a beautiful swirl of human teeth above the door in a widening spiral of size. In the centre, the neat little shovels of incisors, tessellated with arched canines and ringed all around with the long, racine tusks of molars. In neat print, the label on the door read, Number 14-8, Diversion, Procedural Chamber. Beneath the neat print, a more elaborate hand had written in fainter ink, Avulsion!
Here we are, said Dulcinea. Before we go through, please give me a little bit of your blood. I have warded the place up and down, and I'm dreadfully afraid you won't be able to go through the door without giving me a shock.
This little nod to paranoia made Harrow's shoulders relax minutely. Gideon looked to her, and Harrow Hark nodded. In the dim and dusty foyer, both offered up their hands to be pricked. The necromancer of the seventh tilted her head, beautiful brown ringlets spilling over her shoulders, and took blood from their thumbs and their ring fingers. Then she pressed the blood into her palm and spat delicately with what Gideon noticed was pink-tinged spittle. She pressed her thin hand to the door.
It's not a hold ward, Dulcinea explained, but it's not just physical. The ward will alert me if the immaterial try to pass, if they've instantiated, I mean, if they've crossed over. I don't want to stop them, she added, when Harrow Hark started fidgeting with a bone fragment from her pocket. I want to see whatever would try to sneak in on us. I want to know what it looks like. Let's go.
Rather than the neatly sectional space that had constituted Laboratory 2, with its imaging and response chambers and orderly empty shelves, Laboratory 8 opened up on an enormous grate. A lattice of thick black steel barred the first part of the room from the second, which, espied through the holes, proved to be a long space with a claustrophobic ceiling. It was like stepping into a pipe. The door led to a metal platform on struts and a short flight of stairs leading down into the space, barred by the huge grate. The seventh necromancer went to the wall and flicked a switch, and with a low vibrating moan, the grate slowly began to tuck itself up into the ceiling. With the removal of the grate, the room seemed enormously grey and empty. Only two things broke up the vast monotony of grey metal and white light. Far off at the other end of the chamber was a metal plinth, boxed on top with what looked like clear glass or plex, and at the bottom of the stairs, about a metre away from its base, was a yellow and black striped line that had been painted horizontally from wall to wall. It was easily 100 metres from the stripe to the plinth, a long way to walk. It looked simple enough, which was how Gideon knew it was probably a huge pain in the ass. And yet her adept was already gliding down the stairs, standing before the yellow and black emblazoned line as though at the edge of a fire. Dulcinea came after, leaning more heavily on her crutches as she swung herself down the stairs. Protesilaus came last.
If you put your hand through, she said, you'll see... There!
Harrow had bitten off a cry of pain. She had stuck her gloved fingers tentatively over the line, and now she was yanking off her glove to see the damage. Gideon had been the victim of this once before, through Palamedes Sextus, but it was still a disquieting sight. Harrow's fingertips had shriveled, the nails had split horribly, and the moisture looked as though it had been siphoned forcibly out, wrinkling the skin like paper. Her adept shook her hand in the air like you would with a burn. The wrinkles smoothed out slowly, and the nails knit themselves back together.
Hardly insurmountable, said Harrow, having regained her composure. Very hopeful. What would you use?
A corporeal ward. Skin-bound, tight focus.
Try it.
Harrow Hark flexed her fingers slowly. Gideon watched as she narrowed her eyes into obsidian slits, fringed thickly with blunt black lashes, and then extended her hand beyond the line again. There was a brief shower of blue sparks. Harrow snatched her hand back, amazed and furious. The fingers had withered into puckered twigs. Her little nail had fallen off entirely. The edges of her sleeve had holed and frayed as though assaulted by moths. Gideon lunged out of a sheer desire to do something, but Harrow held her back with her healthy hand, staring fixedly at the hurt one as it slowly mended. Dulcinea watched with eager eyes. Protesilaus hulked next to the stairs. Harrow shook a bracelet over her hurt hand, and bands of spongy, osseous matter wrapped around her knuckles before forming thick plaques of bone. Gauntleted, she reached her hand out again. "It won't work," said Dulcinea, dimpling. The gauntlet exploded into fragments of bone. Those that passed the yellow line fragmented further, and those bits degraded into dust, and that into powder. The glove fell away in hunks, dwindling into fine sand before it even hit the ground, and Harrow yanked her hand back to stare at its sad, puckered appearance a third time. She sat heavily on the stairs, and a bead of blood sweat trickled down one temple as, away from the barrier, her hand relaxed back into wholeness. Gideon longed to say, "What the fuck?" "It's two spells overlaying each other," said Dulcinea. "You can't have two spells with coterminous bounds. It's impossible." "But true. They're really coterminous, not just interwoven nor spliced. It's truly delicious work. The people who set it in place were geniuses."
"Then one half is senescence."
"And the other half is an entropy field," said Dulcinea simply. Gideon followed Harrow's gaze over the long, dully gleaming field of corrugated metal and the plinth shining at the end like a beacon. She saw Harrow suck in and bite the inside of one cheek, always a sign of furious thinking, flexing her fingers all the while as though still worried about their integrity. She took an old, ivory-coloured knuckle from her pocket and she passed it to Gideon.
"Throw," she commanded.
Gideon obligingly threw. It was a good toss. The knuckle hit the field high and travelled for about half a metre before fragmenting into a rain of grey particles. Harrow's gaze fixed on the crumbling shards. More tiny spikes and spurs of bone burst out of them and shrivelled stillborn. Another burst as Harrow curled her fist into a ball. Then nothing. There was no more bone left. Dulcinea breathed in admiration. "It's awful quick."
"Then," said the adept of the House of the Ninth, "it is, and I don't say this lightly, impossible. This is the most efficient death trap I've ever seen. The senescence decays anything before it can cross, and the entropy field, God knows how it's holding, disperses any magical attempt to control the rate of decay. But why hasn't the whole room collapsed? The walls should be so much dust."
"The field and the flooring are a few micrometres apart. Maybe the Ninth could make a very, very weeny construct to go through that gap," said the Seventh helpfully. Harrow said, in bottom-of-the-ocean tones,
"The Ninth House has not practised its art on weeny constructs."
"Before you ask, it's not a lateral puzzle either," said Dulcinea. "You can't go through the floor because it's solid steel, and you can't go through the ceiling because that's also solid steel, and there's no other access. And Palamedes Sextus estimated you could walk for probably 3 seconds before you died." Hera got very focused very suddenly.
"Sextus has seen this?"
"I asked him first," said Dulcinea, "and when I told him the method, he said he'd never do it. I thought that was fascinating. I'd love to get to know him better." That got every particle of Harrow Hark known as Jesimus' attention. Dulcinea absently tossed her crutches to Protesilaus one by one, and he caught them out of the air as though he didn't even have to think about it, which Gideon had to admit was cool. She sat down heavily on the stairs, quite close to Harrow, and she said,
"There is one way of doing it, and he wouldn't. I'm sorry that I didn't admit it, but you were my second choice. If black vestals won't cross this line, I don't think anyone will, and I can't, because I physically can't walk the whole way unassisted. If I faint or go funny halfway there, it will mean my timely death."
"And what is it," said Harrow, in a voice that meant trouble, "that even Palamedes Sextus won't do?"
"He won't siphon," said Dulcinea.
The shutters on Harrow's face were pulled shut.
"And nor will I," she said. "I don't mean soul siphoning, not quite. When Master Octocizeron siphons his cavalier, he sends the soul elsewhere and then exploits the space it leaves behind. The power that rushes in to fill that space will keep refilling for as long as either of them can survive. You wouldn't have to send anyone anywhere, but the entropy field will drain your own reserves of thanagy as soon as you cross the line, so you need to draw on a power source on this side of the line, where the field can't touch it. Do you understand?"
"Don't patronise me, Lady Septimus. Of course I understand. Understanding a problem is nowhere near the same as implementing a solution. You should have asked Octocizeron and his human vein."
"I probably would have," said Dulcinea candidly, "if Pro hadn't blacked his eye for him."
"So technically," said Harrow, acid as a battery, "we're your third choice."
"Well, Abigail Pent was a very talented spirit magician," said Dulcinea, and relented when she saw Harrow's expression. "I'm sorry, I'm teasing. No, I don't think I would have asked the Eighth House, Reverend Daughter. There is something cold and white and inflexible about the Eighth. They could have done this with ease, maybe, that's why. And now Abigail Pent is dead. What am I to do? If you were to ask Sextus for me, do you think he'd do it? You seem to know him better than me."
Harrow pushed herself up from the stairs. She had not seemed to notice that Dulcinea was leaning with her flower-like face in her hands and drinking in her every movement, nor her expression of carefully studied innocence. Gideon was undergoing complicated feelings about not being the centre of the Seventh's attention. With a flourish of inky skirts, Harrow Hark turned back to the stairs, staring through Dulcinea rather than at her.
"Let's say I agree with your theory," she said. "To maintain enough thanagy for my wards inside the field, I'd need to fix a siphon point outside it. The most reasonable source of thanagy would be you."
"You can't move thanagy from place to place like that," said the Seventh, with very careful gentleness. "It has to be life to death, or death to a sort of life, like the Second do. You'd have to take my thalagy."
She raised a wasted hand, and then let it flutter back to her face like a drifting paper plane.
"Me? I could get you maybe 10 meters?
"We adjourn," said Harrow Hark.
Harrow grasped Gideon hard around the arm and practically dragged her back up the stairs, out past the foyer and into the hallway. The noise of the door slamming behind them echoed around the corridor. Gideon found herself staring straight down the barrel of a loaded Harrow Hark Nona Jesimus, hood shaken back to reveal blazing black eyes in a painted white face.
"Avulsion," she said bitterly. "Of course. Nav, I'm going to bear down hard on your trust again."
"Why are you so into this?" asked Gideon. "I know you're not doing it for Dulcinea."
"Let me make my business plain. I have no interest in Septimus's woes," Harrow said. "The Seventh House is not our friend. You're making yourself an utter fool over Dulcinea, and I dislike her cavalier even more."
"Massive slam on Protesilaus out of nowhere," said Gideon.
"But I would finish the challenge that sickened Sextus. Not for the high ground, but because he must learn to stare these things in the face." Do you know what I'd have to do?
Yeah, said Gideon. You're going to suck out my life energy in order to get to the box on the other side.
A ham-fisted summary, but yes. How did you come to that conclusion?
Because it's something Palamedes wouldn't do, she said, and he's a perfect moron over Camilla the Sixth.
Okay.
What do you mean, okay?
I mean, okay, I'll do it, said Gideon, although most of her brain was trying to give the part of her brain saying that a nipple gripple. She chewed at a damp fleck of lip paint and took off her dark glasses and popped them into her pocket. Now she could look Hero dead in the eye.
I'd rather be your battery than feel you rummaging around in my head. You want my juice? I'll give you juice.
Under no circumstances will I ever desire your juice, said her necromancer, mouth getting more desperate. Nev, you don't know precisely what this is asking. I will be draining you dry in order to get to the other side. If at any point you throw me off, if you fail to submit, I die. I have never done this before. The process will be imperfect. You will be in pain.
How do you know?
Hero Hark said, the second house is famed for something similar in reverse. The second necromancer's gift is to drain her dying foes to strengthen and augment her cavalier.
Rad.
It said they all die screaming, said Harrow.
Nice to know that the other houses are also creeps, said Gideon.
Nav,
she said, I'll still do it.
Harrow Hark chewed on the insides of her cheeks so hard that they looked close to staving in. She steepled her fingers together, squeezed her eyelids shut. When she spoke again, she made her voice quite calm and normal.
Why?
Probably because you asked.
The heavy eyelids shuttered open, revealing baleful black irises.
That's all it takes, Griddle. That's all you demand. This is the complex mystery that lies in the pit of your psyche.
Gideon slid her glasses back onto her face, obscuring feelings with tint. She found herself saying,
That's all I ever demanded.
And to maintain face, suffixed it with,
You asswipe.
When they returned, Dulcinea was still sitting on the stairs and talking very quietly to her big cavalier, who had dropped to his haunches and was listening to her as silently as a microphone might listen to its speaker. When she saw that the ninth house pair were back in the room, she staggered to rise. Protesilaus rose with her, silently offering her an arm of support. As Harrow Hark said,
We'll make our attempt.
You could practice if you wanted, said Dulcinea. This won't be easy for you.
I wonder why you made that assumption, said Harrow Hark.
Dulcinea dimpled.
I oughtn't to, ought I, she said. Well, I can at least look after Gideon the Ninth while you're over there.
Gideon still saw no reason why she would need looking after. She stood in front of the stairs feeling like a useless appendage, hand gripping the hilt of her sword as though through sheer effort she could still use it. It seemed dumb to be a cavalier primary with no more use than a big battery. Her necromancer stood in front of her with much the same nonplussedness, hands working over each other as though wondering what to do with them. Then she swept one gloved hand over the side of Gideon's neck, fingers resting on her pulse, and breathed an impatient breath.
It felt like nothing, at first. Besides Harrow touching her neck, which was a one-way trip to No Town, but it was just Harrow touching her neck. She felt the blood pump through the artery. She felt herself swallow, and that swallow go down past the flat of Harrow's hand. Maybe there was a little twinge, a shudder around the skull, a tactual twitch, but it was not the pressure and the jolt she remembered from response and imaging. Her adept took a step back, thoughtful, fingers curling in and out of her palms.
Then she turned and plunged through the barrier. And there was the jolt. It started in Gideon's jaw, starbursts of pain rattling all the way from mandible to molars, electricity blasting over her scalp. She was Hero, walking into no man's land. She was Gideon, skull juddering behind the line. She sat down on the stairs very abruptly and did not pay attention to Dulcinea, reaching out for her before drawing back. It was like Hero had tied a rope to all her pain receptors and was rappelling down a very long drop. She dimly watched her necromancer take step after painstakingly slow step across the empty metal expanse. There was a strange fogging around her. It took Gideon a moment to realize that the spell was eating through Hero's black robes of office, grinding them into dust around her body. Another lightning flash went through her head. Her immediate instinct was to reject it, to push against awareness of Hero, the sense of crushing pressure, the blood transfusion feel of loss. Bright lights danced in her vision. She fell to the side and became disjointedly aware of Dulcinea, her head on Dulcinea's thin thigh, the glasses slipping off her nose and rattling down onto the next step. She watched Hero walk as though against a wind, blurred with particles of black. Then she found herself snorting out big, hideous fountains of blood. Her vision blurred again greyly, and her breath stuttered in her throat.
"No," said Dulcinea. "Oh, no, 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 stay awake."
Gideon couldn't say anything but mainly because blood was coming enthusiastically out of every hole in her face. Then all of a sudden, it wasn't. Drying up, parching, leaving her with a waterless and arid tongue. The pain moved down to her heart and massaged it, electrifying her left arm and her left fingers, her left leg and her left toes. It was beyond pain. It was as though her insides were being sucked out through a gigantic straw. In her dimming vision, she saw Herohark walking away, no longer haloed by fragments but limned with a great yellow light that flickered and ate at her heels and her shoulders. Tears filled Gideon's eyes unbidden, and then they gummed away. It all blurred grey and gold, then just grey.
"Oh, Gideon," someone was saying, "you poor baby."
The pain went down her right leg and to her right toes and then up her spine in zigzags. She dry heaved. There was still that pressure, the pressure of Hero, and the sense that if she pushed at it, if she just went and fucking knocked at it, it would go away. She was sorely tempted. Gideon was in the type of pain where consciousness disappeared and only the animal remained, bucking, yelping an idiot yelp, butting and bleating. Throw Herohark off or slip into sleep, anything for release. If there had been any sense that she had to try to hold the connection, she would have lost it already. Gideon was just overwhelmed with how badly she wanted to shove against it, not huddle in a corner and scream. Was she screaming? Oh shit, she was screaming. "It's all right," someone was saying over the noise. "You're all right. Gideon, Gideon, you're so young. Don't give yourself away. Do you know, it's not worth it. None of this is worth it at all. It's cruel. It's so cruel. You are so young and vital and alive. Gideon, you're all right. Remember this, and don't let anyone do it to you ever again. I'm sorry. We take so much. I'm so sorry." She would remember each word later, loud and clear. Her forehead and face were being mopped. Touch did not register. She had lost control of her limbs, and each was flailing independently of the others, a roiling mass of nerves and panic. Her hair was being stroked softly, and she did not want to be touched, but she was terribly afraid that if it stopped, she would roll away into the field and dissolve just to get away. She held on to the sound of talking so that she didn't go mad.
"She's all the way across," said the voice. "She's made it to the box. Can you see the trick of it, Reverend Daughter?
There is a trick, isn't there? Gideon, I am going to put my hand over your mouth. She needs to think.
A hand went over her mouth, and Gideon bit it.
Oh, you feral! There she goes. Perhaps they thought that if it was easy to obtain, someone could finish the demonstration some other way. It's got to be foolproof, Gideon. I know that. I wish it were me. I wish I were up there. She's got the box open. I wonder. Yes, she's worked it out. I was afraid she'd break the key.
Clutched in the thin lap, Gideon could make no response that was not retching, gurgling, or clamouring, silenced only by one rather skinny hand.
Good girl, the voice was saying. Oh, good girl, she's got it, Gideon, and I've got you. Gideon of the golden eyes, I'm so sorry. This is all my fault. I'm so sorry. Stay with me, the voice said more urgently. Stay with me.
Gideon was suddenly aware that she was very cold. Something had changed. It was getting harder to suck in each breath.
She stumbled, said the voice, detached,
and Gideon heaved, not against the connection, but into it. The consequent pain was so intense that she was afraid she might wet herself, but the spike of cold faded.
She's up, Gideon. Gideon, she's up. Just a little bit more. Darling, you're fine. Poor baby.
Now Gideon was scared. Her body had the soft, drunken feeling you got just before fainting away, and it was very hard to stay conscious. 3 seconds before you die, Palamedes had calculated. Anything less than Hera crossing the threshold would make the struggle meaningless. The hand touched her face, her mouth, her eyebrows, smoothed her temples. As if knowing her thoughts by her face, the voice whispered,
Don't. It's very easy to die, Gideon the Ninth. You just let it happen. It's so much worse when it doesn't. But come on, chicken. Not right now, and not yet.
It felt like all the pressure in her ears was popping loose. The voice said, musical and distant,
Gideon, you magnificent creature, keep going. Feed it to her. She's nearly made it. Gideon? Gideon, eyes open. Stay put. Stay with me.
It took an infinity amount of seconds for her to stay put, for her to crack her eyes open. When her eyes opened, Gideon was distantly worried to discover that she was blind. Colours swam in front of her vision in a melange of muted hues. Something black moved. It took her a moment to realise that it was moving very quickly. It was sprinting. Mildly startled, Gideon realised that she was starting to die. The colours wobbled before her face. The world revolved, then revolved the other way, aimlessly spinning. The air stopped coming. It would have been peaceful, only it sucked. A new voice said,
Gideon? Gideon!
When she opened her eyes again, there was a dazzling moment of clarity and sharpness. Hera Nona Jesimus was kneeling by her side, naked as the day she was spawned. Her hair was shorn a full inch shorter, the tips of her eyelashes were gone, and, most horrifyingly, she was absolutely nude of face paint. It was as though someone had taken a hot washcloth to her. Without paint, she was a point-chinned, narrow-jawed, ferrety person, with high, hard cheekbones and a tall forehead. There was a little divot in her top lip at the philtrum, which gave a bow-like aspect to her otherwise hard and fearless mouth. The world rocked, but it was mainly because Hera was shaking her shoulders.
Ha ha, said Gideon, first time you didn't call me Griddle.
And died.
Well, passed out, but it felt a hell of a lot like dying. Waking up had an air of resurrection, of having spent a winter as a dried-out shell and coming back to the world as a new green shoot. A new green shoot with problems.
Her whole body felt like one traumatized nerve. She was lying within the cradle of thin and wasted arms. She looked up into the soft and weary face of Dulcinea, whose eyes were still the dusty blue of blueberries. When she saw that Gideon was awake, she sparkled to life. "You big baby," she said, and shamelessly kissed her on the forehead. Herohark was sitting on the cold ground opposite. She was wrapped in chilly dignity and Gideon's overcloak. Even the bone studs in her ears had disappeared, leaving little pockmarks where they ought to have been. "Lady Septimus," she said, "unhand my cavalier. Nev, are you able to stand?"
"Oh, Reverend Daughter, no. Give her a minute," Dulcinea begged. "Pro, help her. Don't let her stand alone."
"I do not want you or your cavalier to touch her," said Harrow. Gideon wanted to say, "Nona Jesimus, quit the sacred bat-black vestal act," but found she couldn't say anything. Her mouth felt like a dried-out sponge. Her adept rummaged around in her overcloak pockets and emerged with a few bone chips, which gave rise to the horrible idea that she had stashed them there. "Again, unhand her!" Dulcinea ignored Hera totally.
"You were incredible," she told Gideon. "Astonishing."
"Lady Septimus," the other necromancer repeated. "I will not ask thrice." Gideon could not manage anything better than a very feeble thumbs up in Dulcinea's direction. Dulcinea unwound herself, which was a shame. She was warm, and the room was colder than 10 witches' tits. She reached out one last time to skim a hand over Gideon's forehead. She whispered archly, "Nice hair." Harrow said, "Septimus?" Dulcinea scooted herself back to the stairs. Gideon watched with dim interest as Hera cracked her knuckles and sucked in a breath. Nothing loath, her necromancer leant down and heaved one of Gideon's arms around her skinny shoulders. Before Gideon could even think, "Oh, shit," she had been pulled to stand as Herohark's knees buckled beneath her. There was a bad moment when she wanted to puke, a good moment when she didn't, and a bad moment again when she realised that she only hadn't because she couldn't. The Lady of the Seventh was saying,
"Reverend Daughter, I'm terribly grateful for what you just did. I'm sorry for the cost."
"Don't. It was a business decision. You'll get your key when I'm done."
"But Gideon is not your business."
Dulcinea's hands came to rest in her lap and she tilted her head.
"I see," she said, smiling and somewhat crestfallen.
A barefoot Hera grunted under her breath as she continued to try to haul Gideon up the short flight of stairs, panting for breath by the top step. Gideon could only watch, willing herself to come to full consciousness, astonished by the unreceptivity of her body. It was all she could do to not deliquesce out of Hera's grip. At the top of the stairs, they stopped, and the Reverend Daughter looked back searchingly. She said abruptly, "Why did you want to be a lictor?" Gideon mumbled,
"Harrow, you can't just ask someone why they want to be a lictor," but was roundly ignored.
The older woman was leaning against Protesilaus's arm. She looked extraordinarily sad, even regretful. When she caught Gideon's eye, a tiny smile tugged on the corners of her mouth, then drooped again. Eventually she said,
"I didn't want to die."
Walking back through the chilly foyer out to the corridor was bad. Gideon had to break away from Harrow and rest her cheek on the cold metal panelling next to the door. Her necromancer waited with uncharacteristic patience for her to regain some semblance of consciousness, and they stumbled onward. Gideon drunken, Harrow flinching her bare feet away from the grill.
"You didn't have to be a dick," she found herself saying thickly. "I like her."
"I don't like her," said Herohark. "I don't like her cavalier."
I still don't get why you're all up in arms against what is a very basic man-hulk. Did you get the key?
The key appeared in Hera's other hand, shining silvery white, austerely plain with a single loop for a head and three simple teeth on the shaft.
Nice, said Gideon.
She rummaged in an inner pocket and removed the ring. The key slid next to the hatch key and red response key with an untidy musical tinkle. Then she said,
Sorry your clothes melted.
Nev, said Harrow, with the slow deliberation of someone close to screaming. Stay quiet. You're not entirely well. I underestimated how long it would take me. The field was vicious, much more so than Septimus communicated. It had started to strip the moisture from my eyeballs before I refined on the fly. By which point it had eaten your underwear, said Gideon. Nav! I just had a near-death experience, she said. Let me have my little moment.
How they got all the way up the ladder, Gideon later had no idea. It was with strange, dreamlike precision that Herohark bullied and bolstered her down the long, winding halls of Kanan House and back to the quarters that the Ninth House occupied, without a flicker of magic, Hero wearing nothing but a big black overcloak. Every so often, she wondered if she had, in fact, kicked the bucket, and this was her afterlife, wandering empty halls with a half-naked, chastened Herohark Nona Jesimus, who had no recourse but to be gentle with her, handling her as though at any moment she would explode into wet confetti giblets. She even let Hero steer her toward the blankets that constituted her bed. Gideon was too exhausted to do anything but lie down and sneeze three times in quick succession, each sneeze a migraine gong through sinus and skull bone.
Quit looking at me like that, she eventually commanded Hero, wiping bloody muck onto her hanky. I'm alive.
You nearly weren't, said Hero soberly, and you're not even aggrieved about it. Don't price your life so cheaply, Griddle. I have absolutely no interest in you losing your sense of self-preservation.
What are these theorems for? She suddenly exploded. What did we gain from that? What was the point?
I should have walked away like Sextus, but I don't have the luxury. I need to become Lictor now before...
She bit off her words like meat from a bone. Gideon waited to know before what, but no more was forthcoming. She closed her eyes and waited, but opened them when she panicked and realised that she had forgotten how long it had been since she had shut them. Herohark was sitting there with that same curious expression on her paintless face, looking thoroughly unlike herself.
Get some rest, she said imperiously.
For the first time, Gideon obeyed her without compunction.